This is AC2GS.
AC2GS. Sorry I didn't give you any warning before calling you. Over to you, Roy, for the previous question I asked you, or any of the above. Sorry to keep you waiting so long for the science physics section of the TechNet tonight. AC2GS, K2RIW. Go ahead, Dr. Roy.
Okay, no problem, Dick. I just wanted to mention again that the address for the mailbag, because I'm still not really getting anything out of the mailbag, is mailbag@limarktech.net. That's mailbag@limarktech.net. And I think we should go with your question. I was thinking that because of that discourse into digital broadcast television, we would try something simple like relativistic electrodynamics, but maybe we'll do that next week. I just wanted to throw out a couple of little comments before we get to your question. Let me have a drop. Okay, I just wanted to recommend some books for people who like to read books. In fiction, Andy Weir, the guy who wrote The Martian, has a new book, Artemis, about living on the moon as, colonizing the moon and such. It has some scientific facts. It has some scientific fancy. Some people would find it enjoyable, I'm sure. Also, Walter Isaacson of the famous Steve Jobs biography in general, just came out with a biography of Leonardo da Vinci, and that should be interesting. So I just wanted to throw those two little things out there.
Yeah, there are lots of new movies coming out right now, both from National Geographic is one of them, Smithsonian is another one. They're making multiple movies for their particular television channel, which involves colonizing Mars. And they make it sound like it's a given. And now we're discussing the philosophy and the psychology of the people that want to colonize Mars. Various more conservative people are saying, gee, we ought to colonize the moon first. Walk first and run later. Colonizing the moon. The words roll off the tongue real easily. A surface of the moon. The moon's got a day that lasts for 27 or 28 days. Let me drop. And that moon goes to plus 150 degrees centigrade at high noon. Goes to minus 150 degrees. I'm rounding off the numbers. Minus 150 degrees centigrade at midnight on the moon. That's a ridiculous temperature extreme. You think you're going to design a habitat sitting on the surface that can tolerate those temperatures? Whoa. Tell me about insulating a spacesuit or a habitat from plus 150 degrees centigrade, way beyond the boiling water temperature. The best air conditioning in the world, I'd worry about it failing and cooking that astronaut. So colonizing the moon, if you're on the surface, is nice, simple sounding. You get into the specifics, and we haven't even gotten into where's all the food, water, and air going to come from to maintain all of these astronauts. You've got 5 tons of material on a something like the I can't even remember the name of the spaceship, and 3 or 4 times per year, a rocket goes up to the International Space Station, bringing as much as 5,000 pounds or more of consumables to maintain those astronauts. And they like to believe they're growing their own food and recycling their own water and oxygen. Well, not quite. They're certainly not supplying their own food. And growing food on the moon represents a difficult problem, and dwelling on the surface represents a difficult problem. So, let me drop it. So, we can talk about colonizing, but, wow. Now, that little quick puzzle I gave you guys, Bill thinks he's got the answer. Let's see what Bill's got to say. AC2IS, what's that scale going to say after you evacuate that chamber? K2RIW, you got it, Bill.
Yes, this is AC2IS. After you evacuate the chamber, you lose the buoyancy of the air that you've been standing in, so you appear to be heavier. And also, we should not be going to Mars, we should be going to Titan. Maybe I can get your comments on that, AC2IS.
Just going to Mars, which is 1,000 times further away than the moon, probably represents 1,000 times more cost. and Titan is a hell of a lot further away than that, so just cost-wise, and total amount of time and space exposed to radiation and whatever. Now, you say that the astronaut is going to measure heavier when you evacuate the chamber. Is he heavier by a gram, an ounce, a pound? How much heavier is he going to be? Give me a rough, I mean, is he easily going to resolve that on the scale? You told me he's heavier. Rough, back of the envelope calculation here, Bill. How much heavier? AC2IS, K2LIW?
This is AC2IS. I'm trying to remember what you said about the weight of air. Was it a pound per cubic meter, maybe? So an astronaut would be less than a cubic meter, but basically he would be lighter by the amount of air that he displaces, AC2IS.
Air is something like 1.2 kilograms per cubic meter, which is around 2.7 pounds. So air is around 2.5 or 2.7 pounds per cubic meter. This light stuff that's in the room with you, which you think is weightless, it's far from weightless. Obviously, when you stick your hand out of the window of a car while it's moving, you start feeling the weight of it real fast. A human being, what's the volume of a human being? You can tell pretty easily because a 180-pound man, when he is floating, is displacing 180 pounds of water. And how much volume is 180 pounds of water? It might be half a cubic meter. So, a very rough guess. A human being might have a volume of half a cubic meter. And if a cubic meter of air is 2.5 pounds, he's going to measure 1.25 pounds lighter, a correction heavier. So, when the air is taken out of the chamber, the astronaut will appear to be heavier. Turns out that your weight, measured on a scale, you're a pound lighter than you really are because of the buoyancy of the air that you're in. And we can't put you into a vacuum to really measure your weight because you would die in the process. But ain't that crazy? When you stand on the scale, at least a pound of what that scale is indicating is not your real weight. It's the buoyancy of the air around you. Very few people have realized that, I believe. K2LIW listening, for anybody want to make a comment on this one?
Dick, I'm breaking in for a second with a message, the WHCDL.
Go ahead, Andy.
Yeah, I just got a text message from Bob. He said that he could... He said, it's almost 10 p.m. and I could not stay around to finish the TechNet. Sorry about that, because he had to go. So, can we make it to next week? I'm going to call him this week and we can put him on first on the list, him and I, to be the first one so we don't have to hold him up. So if we do it next week, is that okay?
That's okay. Make the offer.
Okay. So, I only ask him if he would be available next Sunday. All right, thanks, Dick. I'm going back to sleep. WHCDL.
Well, one of the things that I've discovered, Andy, is that if you just had a full meal, I recommend you not lay down and go to sleep for about an hour. When your stomach is doing heavy digestion and you're laying horizontal and sleeping, that can create some problems that I won't go into. But a child might be able to tolerate that. A person more than child age is something to worry about. Do that. So stay vertical for about an hour, Andy. Finish your report or whatever. WS2N, K2IW. Go ahead, Paul.
Yes, just a comment about the books that Roy's talking about. I'm halfway through one of them, the Artemis book. So that's the colonization of the moon story. So what he says is very good. And I heard about the other one, about Da Vinci, on news reports, but I haven't gone near that one. But the Andy Weir one, of course, because he's the one that did the Martian. Back to you, Dick.
Now is as good a time as any to give us the space report, Paul. So go right ahead for the space report. Wait for the beeps and proceed.
Did Roy have anything else for the physics forum?
You're right. I shouldn't have cut him off so soon. Roy, AC2GS. I'm all confused tonight. You got it, Roy.
AC2GS. Well, it's okay if we cut it short, because Paul has his space report. Again, I have a couple of little things that won't take up too much time to have people kind of ponder. It's sort of amateur. It's sort of radio, but it's biology also. They have the first digital pill out. It's called Amplify MyCite. It's an antipsychotic medication that has an RF chip in it to show that the individuals took the pill. And this is to treat psychotics, usually schizophrenics, paranoid schizophrenics. So it seems like a perfect idea to give a paranoid schizophrenic a pill that transmits signals back and forth. And also I wanted to mention that a lot of you might have heard or read that high blood pressure has been redefined 10 millimeters of mercury down. So 50% of the American public is now hypertensive, and that's 85% for those people 65 years and older. So welcome to the club, guys.
So being in the middle of normal range, in other words, a typical human being, is no longer healthy. So more than half of the aged population is now, as far as hypertension is concerned, high blood pressure, we're now technically unhealthy. Seems to be what we're saying here, as I see it, Roy. And medications to lower blood pressure are themselves kind of troublesome, and the medication's success rate, I think, is not as far from 100%. So once we conclude that with the new standard that more than half the population of the aged population is hypertensive, a suggested solution for this is not going to be easy, is it? AC2GS, K2LIW?
No, not at all. Unfortunately, it's not a statistical normalcy where 50% applies. It's correlated with the increased risk of heart disease, diabetes, and all those other wonderful things. If you're overweight, losing weight can be effective. To some people, a lower salt diet might be effective, and some moderate exercise also might be effective. Short of that, it's magic pills, unfortunately, or you risk elevated risks of heart attacks and strokes and all kinds of things. The problem is blood pressure is kind of dangerous. It's like high-pressure pipes. You enjoy the hot shower, but the chance of your pipes busting increases if you increase the pressure. So it goes the same. So probably the lowest blood pressure you can tolerate without fainting is the healthiest, but that's a problem in and of itself.
So if a person now is conscientious and he does a certain amount of exercise per day, he's already given up smoking, he's trying to control his sodium intake, if he's one of the people that properly responds to that, he gets enough sleep, he's done all the right things, and his blood pressure is still 140 over 90. It sounds like the only thing left for him to do is to use pharmaceuticals, and some of the side effects of those pharmaceuticals are not always pleasant, and some of them are probably expensive. So if he's done the right things, and the people who claim they're doing the right things, my guess is only half of those people will get the amount of improvement they require. A certain percentage of those people claiming to do the right things are still not going to get enough improvement. After that, the choices are not so easy, are they, Roy? AC2GS, K2LIW?
No, unfortunately not. But a lot of times people kind of white lie their way through things. They say they've cut down their salt. They say they've increased their exercise. They say they've tried to lose weight, but behavior modification is very, very difficult, and that's why people end up with taking magic pills. And with pills, it's always a risk-benefit ratio. You have to decide what the side effects, what the risks are versus the benefits. And for many of the high blood pressure medications, they're relatively safe, And we know from experience all the people who die prematurely from poorly controlled blood pressure. So it's the only game in town beyond behavior modification at this point. We can't reset people's kidneys for a different level of pressure and such. It would be nice if we could.
When you studied the American population, particularly the senior citizens, I think an extremely high percentage of them are technically overweight. We're now discovering that an extremely high percentage of them are hypertensive. You put those two combinations together, overweight, hypertensive, and some of those people are taking all kinds of pharmaceuticals. I know a number of my friends have a whole bunch of pharmaceutical bottles lined up on the table, so to speak, of what they're taking every day. Some of them are going to multiple physicians that are not even talking to each other. And some of the combinations of pharmaceuticals, medications, are not good combinations. And many medications might do great things when you first start taking it, but in your second and third year of using that medication, the body changes in such a way that what you think is the proper dosage is far from the right dosage, or you start developing side effects from the longevity of the use of that pharmaceutical. Not a simple situation. I don't envy the field that you're in, Roy. You've got some very difficult choices that are not always simple, and you do this and the problem goes away. EC2GS, KQLIW. Am I too pessimistic?
Well, no, it's a challenge. It's a challenge to find the right mix. It's a challenge to convince people to take the medicine as directed. And it's never a good idea to have too many cooks. They spoil the broth, if you will. As long as a person is insured by one insurer, you can probably figure out all the medications that's being written for them. That's the miracle of modern electronic prescriptions. It's all in a database, and I can pull other people's prescriptions that they wrote for my patient, unless they have parallel insurance from their spouses. So that's less of a problem these days than it was when you could write things in paper and pen.
EC2IS, comment.
So it sounds like it is getting better. Wait for the beeps and you got a pill.
Okay, just wanted to go back to the volume of an astronaut and the amount of weight he might displace. According to Google, standard average human being displaces about 71 liters. So that's significantly less than a cubic meter, which is around 1,000 liters. So less than a tenth. I think our astronaut displaces less than a pound's worth of air. AC2IS.
Okay. You think a human being has a volume of 71 liters. Okay. Each liter of water, 2 pounds. 71 liters would be 140 pounds. So you think the average astronaut is only 140 pounds, Bill? Go ahead.
I did a search in Google, volume of a person in cubic meters, and so without even needing to click on a link, Google pops up right at the top of the screen. To find volume, you need the equation for volume. Volume is equal to mass divided by density, so knowing two of three variables, we have a mass of 70 kilograms divided by a density of 985 kilograms per cubic meter equal to our volume, or 0.0711 cubic meters. 1 cubic meter is 1,000 liters, and a human is about 71 liters. I can click on a link and see if I get something else. AC2IS.
That's close enough. Okay. So we may have the numbers a little bit wrong, but the philosophy is still in the right direction. That you're going to weigh a little bit heavier when the air is taken out of the chamber. Another factor that I was including is the fact that I now know what's going on. The way the spacesuit inflates with a human being inside, the total volume of that spacesuit, the outer volume, is is almost twice the volume of the human being that's on the inside of it. So therefore, with that spacesuit inflated, he is displacing quite a bit more air. So you're not putting a human being in the vacuum. You're putting a human being inside of a spacesuit in the vacuum. That spacesuit in general is doubling the girth of your arms, your legs, and so on. Certainly your head. So there's more displacement going on there. But we see the trend. Is there anything else you want to give us for puzzles to be considering, Roy, between now and next week? AC2GS, K2RIW, you got it, Roy.
Okay, do you want me to set up the relativistic electrodynamics thought experiment now and answer it next week? Would you like that?
Okay, the words sound complicated, but it's your choice. Go right ahead, Roy.
Promise you it'll be a lot less complicated than the digital broadcast television. It's rather a simple setup. You got some guy, let's say Joe, YRR, he's in a rocket ship. The rocket ship is accelerating at 9.8 meters per second. Joe has a big metal ball, which he can make charge. So it's now an electrostatically charged ball in a rocket ship that's traveling 9.8 meters per second acceleration. So 9.8 meters per second per second. And the question will be, depending upon his test equipment, what is he seeing? Is he seeing just an electrostatic field? Is he seeing a magnetic field? Is he seeing an electromagnetic field? And we'll go into the details of all that next week. So that's simple, right?
Yeah, fairly simple sounding. And by the way, Joe's call letters are WHRYY. Romeo, Yankee, Yankee. You've been calling him Yankee, Romeo, Romeo, both in your email and on the air right now. He's RYY. So there's a double letter in there, but something got switched. And, okay, that sounds like a fun puzzle, and we'll be discussing that next week. I think it's time for the space report. Paul, WS2N, what's NASA doing? And when you do an investigation of Smithsonian and National Geographic, you'll find out that both of them are making movies about colonizing Mars. And my goodness, are they optimistic, in my opinion. Let me drop this. Quite a few people you listen to, I mean, even Elon Musk and the hardware he's building, he makes it sound like within a very small number of years, he's going to be sending human beings at least circling Mars and coming back home, as well as possibly landing. He thinks that colonizing Mars just requires him to produce some good spaceships, space capsules, and thrusting machines. In order to land on Mars, which really means arrive, survive, thrive, and stay alive for a long period of time, you've got to be generating food to have a Congo line of spaceships, like the cargo spaceships going up to the International Space Station. To do that on Mars, out of the question. On top of that, if you develop a medical problem on your way to Mars, and you want to be rescued, there is no rescue as I see it. So a lot of cost, a lot of risk, a lot of disadvantages, and survival there. We're glossing over way too many things with the way the subject is being discussed on these National Geographic and Smithsonian movies. They're fun to watch. The movie The Martian is fun to watch, but an awful lot of the details are essentially incorrect. WS2N, K2RIW, go ahead, Paul.
This is WS2N for the Space Report. Elon Musk, I saw him on an interview many years ago, and he did say that he wants to build a spaceship to get there. Infrastructure, leave that up to somebody else. But, you know, his analogy was, you know, if it was hundreds of years ago, he would be building the ships to come to the new world and let the king and queen worry about, you know, who's going to put the houses up and grow the food. So, you know, to some extent you're right. That's the way he thinks. He's hoping somebody else steps in to cure the big problem. But he still has to cure the radiation problems and going from the, you know, from Earth to Mars and back, and food problems. You know, he's got his work cut out for him, but he's working on it. He's not there yet, that's for sure. Now, okay, I just want to talk about a launch that occurred last Tuesday from Vandenberg in California. It was a NOAA mission, National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. They teamed up with NASA, but it's their project. It's a climate satellite. They call it the JPSS, the Joint Polar Satellite System. There's going to be three more of these things that will eventually be going up, and they have high resolution cameras and all sorts of equipment for detecting weather, and they intend on being able to predict hurricanes that are, you know, 4 or 5 days out, maybe 7 days out, and other weather events. They plan on being able to see if there's big power outages throughout the area. They'll be able to tell every 24 hours, you know, how bad that situation is. So they launched that from California. After a couple of scrubs, they had weather problems. They had a boat that was downrange. So a couple of days, a couple of scrubs, but they finally got it off on a Delta II rocket. Delta IIs are being phased out. They've been around for since 1989, and they're slowly being phased out. Delta II was the 7908 configuration. That was 9 solid booster rockets. You know, the 979. 7 is the what iteration of the Delta it was. That 9 stood for 9 boosters. 6 of the boosters light off with the main engine, and when they burn out, the other 3 boosters come on. Very powerful rocket, but it put it into polar orbit successfully, and it's finally up there. There's been, you know, quite a few years delay on this, and they've been trying to get it up there. The instrument problems, they worked everything out, and everything, from what I read, is doing good. On board was CubeSats. There were 4 CubeSats that were deployed. They go for a ride with the big satellite, and one of them was a CubeSat that had that's an amateur radio satellite, and they call it Fox 1B satellite. So that'll be I guess it's in operation now. I haven't read, but if you have the equipment, it's 435.250 megahertz. So, you know, you're using 70 centimeters going up, and then down is going to be 145.960 megahertz. From what I understand, you're supposed to download some kind of software. I haven't figured that part out yet to contact the satellite. But, you know, it'll be going around. You should be able to contact the satellite at least once a day, maybe twice a day, depending on the you know, how far away you are on its orbital plane. It's going to be almost polar. So, for instance, if it's just east of you as it goes by, the next pass you might be able to pick it up as well an hour and a half later. So I thought that was interesting, and I'm glad NOAA got to launch it, because there's been a lot of movements to, you know, in the administration to do away with anything to do with climate satellites. But I guess these are on the books, and they probably can't get rid of them. So that's good to see that that thing goes that particular satellite was launched, because that tells me the other three are going to be launched as well. And one thing we need is better hurricane warnings. Another mission that was successfully completed, Cygnus was launched by Antares last week, and actually it was two Saturdays ago, but it docked with the International Space Station. It's actually berthed, the proper term is berthed, with the Unity module that the Earth's facing side. So they grabbed it with the robotic arm. You have six astronauts living on board right now. And one of the Americans grabbed it with the 57-foot Canadian-built robotic arm and attached it to the Unity module. If you ever see pictures of the Cygnus cargo vehicle, it's got these big round solar arrays that are attached to it. It's built by Germany. And they replaced the older version, the ones that came out, rectangular type of unfolding system that's been done away with in the last couple of flights. I guess about four or five flights now of Cygnus has these big, I guess they're about 14 feet each in diameter, and they unfurl like a big fan. But I'm amazed on how many kilowatts these things put out. They put out almost 4 kilowatts. It's almost like a generator in your house. 3.7, I think they said, kilowatts of power. So Cygnus is successfully berthed, and they brought up over 7,000, around 7,500 pounds of stuff to the six astronauts that are on board. Okay,
WB2CL.
We're on the topic, so we'll cover. We got time. This is WS2N. The Sierra Nevada Corporation, called SNC, they're the ones building Dream Chaser. I think I mentioned it last week. That Dream Chaser is the spacecraft that kind of looks like the space shuttle. It's about 25% the same, the size of the space shuttle. They successfully dropped it from a helicopter, and it was up about a mile, and within 60 seconds, it flew down to the runway at Edwards Air Force Base. Successfully landed. This time it was a successful landing. The last time they tried it was back in about 4 years ago, 2013, and everything worked out good, but when it came up for a landing, the wheel collapsed. So that's all been replaced. A lot of changes on the Dream Chaser. So SNC, the report I read, is everything's go. They won't need to retest this, refly it in that fashion anymore. They'll finish building the one that they tested is not the flight piece, but they're going to put that back in storage. They're building the cargo version, and that's going to be flown probably 2020, maybe 2019, late 2019. And that's the one that has these folded up wings. They're going to mount it into the fairing of an Atlas V rocket, blast out to the International Space Station and other locations they have planned for it. And eventually that will become it will morph into a crewed version of itself. Instead of just being a cargo vehicle, it will be able to carry up to 7 passengers. That's probably, you know, 2025 or something like that, before they ever get that far, maybe later. But that's definitely on the drawing boards. In fact, it started off that way. It was going to be a crewed vehicle, and it turned into a cargo vehicle because of the contract they got with NASA. There was another launch last week of a Black Bart. Correction, it was a Black Brant sounding rocket from Wallops Island, Virginia. Suborbital flight, but it was interesting because they wanted to test the 58-foot diameter, 60-foot diameter parachute that will eventually carry the new rover, the 2020 rover, similar looking to the Curiosity rover, to Mars. So we'll see about that. I haven't mentioned SpaceX. It looks like they're going to hold off on the next 3 or 4 launches that they have planned. That's what was planned for now until the end of 2017. They have some problems. I haven't gotten the exact problem why they have a problem, but they have a problem with the bearings on top of the rocket. They know that there's a problem. My guess is the way it opens, maybe they think it's going to get hung up, and they detected a problem on the last flight, or maybe some other way of detecting something, but they know that there's a problem, and when I find out what it is, I will let you know about it. But because of this bearing apparently not being able to open properly, they've pretty much grounded their next 3 flights until they straighten the problem out. So, talking about Elon Musk and SpaceX, I guess we'll have to wait on that. Those important flights. One of them will be Falcon 9 Heavy. 3 Falcon 9s bolted together, launched from Florida. And that's going to be their first test of their heavy launch vehicle. They do have another plan for cargo launch up to the International Space Station with the Dragon. And that won't be a problem, because when the Dragon is launched, they don't have a fairing around. There's no fairing involved. The Dragon spacecraft just sits on top of the Falcon 9 and gets to space that way. That's pretty much it for now, Dick. We'll turn it over to you. This is WS2N for the Space Night Report on the TechNet. K2RAW, WS2N.
I think I heard somebody sign in that they wanted to ask a question or make a comment. Who was that person? K2RIW listening.
Dick, it's me, WB2CLN. How you doing, Dick, and everybody else? In the Catskill Mountains here, WB2CLN. Go ahead, Dick.
Okay, WB2CLN, K2RIW. Do you have a question or a comment? Go ahead.
Well, Warp Drive, in honor of Star Trek, Warp Drive is almost worked out. And I remember the discussion from last week. With Warp Drive, we'll be to Mars from Earth in just a few days. So there you have it. if you don't know how it's being done, think of outer space as a carpet. And if you pull a carpet up, you punch through the carpet. So 10 feet can be 1 inch punching through the carpet. So that's warp drive. Go ahead, Dick.
Yeah, warp drive, warp speed, makes nice science fiction. Beaming down makes nice science fiction. I mean, the repetitiveness of climbing into a shuttlecraft and transporting yourself down from the spacecraft to the surface of a planet repetitively, they knew that would get boring. So Star Trek invented the beaming down. When you think of the amount of complication of all of the individual components of the DNA of one single cell of a human being, and you've got hundreds of billions of cells in a human being, you think you're going to take that all apart, ship it electronically, and reassemble it correctly on the other side? Wow. And in the case of a warp drive, you're going to go multiple times the speed of light. When just getting up to the edge of speed of light takes an infinite amount of energy. So both of those make nice science fiction. There's a fair amount of, let me drop. There's a fair amount of hard physics suggesting that your great-great-great-grandchildren will not be beaming down from a spacecraft to the planet's surface. And by the same token, your great-great-grandchildren are probably not going to be experiencing the benefits of warp drive. An awful lot of science fiction, like the Dick Tracy radio, did become a reality. So people will say that, yeah, that was very fanciful at the time, and yet here we are with very compact cell phones that do that. That doesn't mean that that warp drive and beaming down are going to take place. So if you think somebody has already got that developed and keeping it secret, I highly doubt that, Tom. WB2CLN, how soon do you think they're going to take place? K2RIW, you got it, Tom.
Hey, okay there, Dick and company, WB2CLN, Portable 2. Well, look, teleportation, no. I don't think it's ever going to be possible. As far as warp drive, I should say under the speed of light, not over it. But yeah, they believe it or not, they have it almost worked out for warp drive. The gravity is, think of gravity as a carpet. And if you pull a carpet up, you can punch through it. So that's warp drive in the present sense. I forgot what with Star Trek what warp drive was to them. I don't know, but hey, we can be at Mars in just a few days, you know. But it's less than the speed of light. Anyway, pass it around there, Dick. I guess you're in charge here. It's cold. It's snowy. I'm getting out of here in a couple of days, packing up for 6 months, getting the hell out of here. It's 30 degrees, going down about 26, and a little snow. Up here in the Catskill Mountains, near Liberty, New York. Go ahead there, Dick. WB2CLN.
And WS2N, a comment about the James Webb Space Telescope.
Yeah, let's hear about the James Webb Space Telescope. I think it was going to be launched in the tail end of 2018. I think it's been moved to 2019. But there's some beautiful YouTube videos you can find demonstrating what the James Webb Space Telescope is going to look like and what it's going to be able to do. A beautiful machine. WS2N, K2RIW, Great Ball.
And Tom mentioned snow. We don't want to hear that down here, Tom. The comment I wanted to make is you recommended Dr. Amber Strauss. She's been involved with the James Webb Space Telescope for quite a while, and she had that 1 hour and 15 minute video on YouTube. I highly recommend it. I sat through that whole thing, Dick. That was fantastic. Recommended that, I believe, last week.
Yes, I did. She's a very well-qualified lady with all kinds of credentials, and she's part of the development team. She works at the Space Science Telescope Institute. I can't think of the exact name of it. Paul will tell us that again. I don't have it written down in front of me. I keep forgetting it. But she's one of the developers of the hardware. Doing a real good job, and when you listen to that particular lecture of hers, were you able to find the lecture by the method that I described, where you go to YouTube video and you do a search on her name? That's one of the easiest ways to find it, to actually give somebody the complete URL, which has uppercase and lowercase components, and it's case sensitive. It's not so easy to tell somebody the exact URL. How would you, Paul? So how did you find it, WS2N, K2RIW?
I had two clues. You said the word Amber, and you also said 1 hour and 15 minutes. When I found the YouTube, that was 1 hour and 15 minutes. and I got it on the first try. Very well done. But they talked about, yeah, I mean, they talked about everything, the overall view of it. But I thought they were going to talk a little bit more about the heat shield, but she did pretty good. She said it was made of the Kapton material, and some of the stuff that I heard, I knew, but a lot of it I didn't.
I'm trying to remember some of the specifics right now. Quite a few of the things she brought out in her lecture. I think it was an hour and 15 minutes, something like that. She gave us quite a few details you don't normally get about how it's built, how it works, what it can do. One hell of a piece of hardware. And a little bit on the expensive side, total number of dollars. However, it's being spread out over a significant number of years. I'd like to believe that the National Science Foundation funding that. No, it's coming out of the NASA budget, but I wonder if NSF has any contribution to that particular piece of hardware. What do you think, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
Yeah, I would imagine so, but it is an expensive project. Now, that was, you could tell that was last year, because they were talking about next year, at the end of next year, it's going to be launched, which is 2018. So that's probably almost a year old. Right now, it's going to be beginning of 2019. But she did talk about the heat shield. And I like the one comment, the amount of heat on one side compared to the other side is going to be 600 degrees. Now, some of the things I'll tell you, I don't remember if she said or if it's things I've read in the past, but each of those five sheets that are going to create this sunshade, each one is basically a little different. I mean, even the size of it is slightly different. The one on the bottom is very flat. As you go higher up, it becomes more and more concave. All the way to the top one. There's four that are really necessary. The fifth is, well, just in case, because you might get some micrometeorites that might go through it, and we need that extra resistance. Each of the sun shields are doped with like aluminum throughout the whole shield. They needed to be conductive. They needed to be all grounded to the main bus of the spacecraft. They don't need any capacitive buildups and all, but electric discharge between critical plate. I'm thinking of a capacitor, one plate into the other plate. From one sheet to the other sheet, you don't want something arcing over. So it's all electrically conductive. Some of the other details, but that's all I remember about the shield, the shade. It's got always be facing the sun. Back to the day. I mean, it's Roy Y.
Go ahead, Joe.
In listening to different news broadcasts about a certain country testing their missiles to see if they can, carry warheads, and the time of going up through the atmosphere and coming down, they said they'd have a hard time testing that. They were using something like a rocket engine to test it. That develops up to, about 2,000, 3,000 degrees of temperature, and they said that's still not hot enough compared to the reentry temperature a vehicle would be exposed to. Do you think that's correct?
I heard that, Joe.
Go ahead, Paul.
I heard that report. Yeah, coming back through the atmosphere, you could probably get up to 3,000, 3,500. You're going to get up to 4,000 or more, if you come back from the moon or Mars. So, the temperature wasn't hot enough with the rocket engine that they're blasting onto the outer coating of this nose cone, so they're getting an improper test, but I guess, you know, they're probably happy with it. That's the best they're going to get, but it still won't be hot enough to duplicate the reentry, Joe.
Yeah, the word reentry, let me drop. The word reentry is very dependent on reentry from where. If you're in low Earth orbit, and you're moving 17,500 miles an hour to be in that orbit, the beginning of your reentry, you're hitting the atmosphere at that speed. When you're coming back from the moon, you're falling a much greater distance toward the mass center of the Earth, and you hit numbers more like 24,000 miles an hour. So the further out in space you go, when you come back, you're falling through a greater distance, and you end up with a higher velocity when you hit that atmosphere. So the amount of heat you get decelerating from 24,000 miles an hour is a hell of a lot higher. We're out of time. Okay, that was space report number 277. That was TechNet number 1,677. Be kind to each other. We'll be back next week. I'll pass it over to Roy if he wants to make any other final comments. And maybe he wants to repeat the website address. AC2GS. K2RIW. Go ahead, Roy.
Thank you, Dick. This is AC2GS, and the mailbag's address, once again, is mailbag@limarktech.net. And thanks for the chance to be here and to talk to you tonight, and we'll do it all again next week. And if good old Tom wants to discuss wormholes, we can discuss those as well next week. So this is AC2GS, and have a great week.
K2RIW, WB2GXM.
Mr. GXM, go ahead.
I've done some research, and there actually is a case of a ham using a Balaam with an M. Before the Balaam was invented, this one amateur invited an umpire from a baseball game over to his house. He had the guy hold the coax in one hand and the antenna in the other hand, and he had the guy move until he got the lowest SWR. He was called a balanced umpire. WB2GXM.
Okay. But it's an interesting case, but it doesn't exist as an electronic component. B-A-L-U-N or L-B-A-L-U-U-N, N for Nancy. Quite a few people mispronounced Balin. I gotta go away. Bye-bye, you all. See you next week.
Yeah, 73 Zol, WB2CON. And keep warm. Oh boy, I tell you, about a week ago, it went down to 10 degrees up here. So, keep warm, winter is coming.
The time is 12:04 a.m. 73, and good night from the W2VL repeater.
For visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear. Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system. Node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
Time is 5 a.m. Net tonight at 8:30. This is the WQVL Amateur Radio Repeater System. 30 WQVL repeater system.
Thank you.